Today is Wednesday, May 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the confusion continues over U.S. policy on North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un.
I view it as a man. Perhaps he wants to get attention.
U.K. uncertainty continues as candidates line up to take the place of the resigning Prime Minister Theresa May. Also ahead, paying tribute to Aretha Franklin at the Pulitzer Prize Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday that while in Japan that he's not worried about North Korean missile tests. The comments contradicted his national security advisor John Bolton, who said the tests violated a U.N. Security Council resolution. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortegas asked by reporters Tuesday to make clear the State Department's position after Trump appeared to contradict his advisor.
The entire North Korean Demyeondaem program, it's in conflict with the U.N. security resolutions. But what the U.S. is focused on here, what the secretary is focused on, where he's trying to support the president, is in trying to negotiate a peaceful end to the North Korean Demyeondaem program. And we have said many times and will continue to reiterate that the economic sanctions will remain in place until we're there.
After two failed summits between Kim and Trump in the past year, North Korea test-fired several rockets and missiles this month, including several guided missiles that experts said could be used to penetrate South Korean and U.S. defenses in the region. Joining us to talk more about this is Dr. Lauren Richardson, Director of Studies at the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the Australian National University. What is your view on this?
I think that it is clearly a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea's tests, because North Korea did fire short-range ballistic missiles. I think that Trump's denial of that is simply part of whatever diplomatic strategy he has toward North Korea. I think it's a bit surprising that he's come out publicly and said that. I think it could partly be because if you look at the timing of his recent statements about North Korea, it was when he was visiting Japan, and obviously Japan is not on very good terms with North Korea. So I think maybe Trump was trying to make clear to North Korea that he still wants to pursue that diplomatic approach. And he was maybe offering North Korea a kind of olive branch there.
Trump said that he thought maybe North Korea was somehow trying to send the U.S. a message. What kind of message would they be sending if that's the case? And do you agree with that?
I don't know that the North Korea was sending the U.S. a message. I mean, it could have been. I think, again, if you look at the timing of the test, it was when there was a great deal of international media attention on the abdication of the Japanese emperor and the new emperor coming to the throne. And I think, you know, North Korea still has very vivid memories of the Japan's colonization of the Korean Peninsula, which was something carried out under the Japanese emperor's name. So it could have been something to do with that, sending a message to Japan. But I think it's also part of North Korea's long-term strategy, which has always been to try to divide the U.S. alliances with Japan and South Korea. And the reason I say that is because they were short-range ballistic missile tests. Those sort of missiles, you know, don't pose a direct threat to the U.S., but they do pose a direct threat to Japan and South Korea, more a problem for Japan now. And so I think that, you know, if Trump, as he's done, has come out and said, well, that's not such a problem, well, that is a problem for the U.S.'s allies. So I think North Korea is probably, you know, succeeding in some sense of driving somewhat of a wedge between the U.S. and its allies on this denuclearization matter.
Are you saying that South Korea and Japan have a right to be concerned that this is a threat? These missile tests are proof that North Korea is continuing to be a threat to them?
Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with the statement released by the Congressional Research Service in the U.S. was that, I mean, these short range, you can't really, Trump is trying to decouple short range ballistic missiles from North Korea's overarching nuclear weapons program, and you can't really do that because North Korea has been attempting for years to be able to develop the capacity to put a nuclear warhead on a ballistic missile, both short range and long range. And obviously its ability to, you know, test these, I mean, in testing these short range nuclear missiles, North Korea is advancing and refining that overall capacity. So it is a threat, not just to Japan and South Korea, but also to the U.S., I think. But Trump's downplaying that.
He says he's open after two failed summits to again sit down with Kim Jong-un. Why would it work a third time if so far it really hasn't achieved anything? And is that a good idea?
I'm of the position, this denuclearization process, if it's ever actually going to happen, is going to take an extremely long time. And, I mean, some people tend to view North Korea's nuclear weapons just sort of in isolation as a nuclear problem that needs to be dealt with, and it can be dealt with just by going straight, addressing that head on and solving this problem quickly. But I see it as more a systemic threat related to the North Korean regime. North Korea has a lot of insecurity, hasn't normalized its relations with Japan and the U.S. I think there's a lot of structural things that need to happen. So I do think that it wouldn't be just one more meeting with the U.S. I think there's always going to have to be, that diplomacy always needs to continue, probably for many years, before there's any real progress on this.
That's Dr. Lauren Richardson, Director of Studies at the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the Australian National University. Well, the next U.S. presidential election is not until November of 2020, but Republican President Donald Trump and the leading Democrat trying to oust him, former Vice President Joe Biden, are launching rhetorical slingshots at each other with lots of gusto. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
In Japan yesterday, the president sided with North Korea's assessment of Biden.
Kim Jong-un made a statement that Joe Biden is a low IQ individual. He probably is, based on his record. I think I agree with him on that.
Biden's campaign says it waited until today to respond out of respect for Memorial Day. Deputy campaign manager Kate Bedingfield says the president's attacks are beneath the dignity of the office, adding that to be on foreign soil on Memorial Day and side with a murderous dictator against a fellow American and a former vice president speaks for itself. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A severe drought is putting 2 million Somalis at a starvation risk. President Trump and Biden continue assailing each other way ahead of the election. Deadly twisters rip through Ohio and Indiana. And Israel is heading toward a political crisis. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Sudanese workers launched a two-day nationwide strike Tuesday. An alliance of unions, professional organizations, and political parties called the strike to pressure the ruling military council to hand power to a civilian authority. Talks between the alliance and the military council, which took power in an April coup, have deadlocked for weeks. For VOA, Jason Patinkin talks to striking workers in the streets of Khartoum.
Chanting anti-government slogans, workers demanding an end to military rule lined up outside the upscale Al-Waha shopping center in downtown Khartoum. Our martyrs lost their lives. We can lose our jobs, they said, referring to the dozens of people killed since December in Sudan's revolution. Tuesday is the first day of a two-day nationwide strike, called by opposition leaders demanding Sudan's military junta hand the government to civilians. The junta took power in April following the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir after months of street protests. Bashir had ruled for nearly 30 years and was accused of human rights abuses and corruption. Talks between protest leaders and the military council collapsed earlier this month after soldiers attacked peaceful demonstrators in the city, killing several and wounding hundreds. Leaders of the protest movement said they are escalating their actions to pressure the military to give up power. A teller at the Bank of Khartoum's Al Wafa Mall branch, Idris Ibrahim, said the Sudanese people are growing impatient. He says they want a civilian government. The military council has had the country for almost 50 days now. We have had negotiations, but they do not seem to want to give us our civilian government. Only one group in the opposition alliance, the Umma Party, led by former Sudanese Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi, refused to participate in the strike, but that seemed to have little effect. Around the nation, workers in various sectors posted photos of themselves on social media holding signs supporting the strike. Oil workers, dentists, sugar processing employees, cement factory workers, and veterinarians were some of the sectors involved. Numerous international flights to Sudan were also canceled as aviation employees threatened to strike. Ibrahim said the upper management of his bank was totally against the strike. A few steps away, his colleague Susanna Abdallah Hassan said she did not care what the bosses thought.
I don't care.
She says she does not care. Even if she is fired, she says it is a small tax for the country. There are people who have lost their lives. The job is nothing, she added. Inside the mall, many shops remained open, but employees supported the strike by refusing to work. At a shop of the MTN mobile phone company, staff politely turned away any potential customers at the door, handing small pieces of paper explaining their support for the strike. At the Sena supermarket, employees lined shopping carts to block shoppers from entering. Throughout Khartoum, most businesses appeared shuttered. There were no reports of violence from protesters, but members of the military council earlier vowed to fire any striking government workers. Video circulated on social media Tuesday appeared to show uniformed security officers arresting staff of an electricity utility. Sudanese electricians had otherwise downed their tools, but said they would ensure power supply to necessary services such as hospitals. Sudan Professionals Association spokesman Amjad Farid condemns the alleged arrests, which he described as illegitimate. He said arrests of workers were a clear violation of their right of political freedom of association. Farid said if the military does not hand power to civilians after the strike ends Wednesday, the opposition alliance will call for further civil disobedience. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The editor-in-chief of China's Global Times said Tuesday that Beijing is seriously considering restricting exports from the United States of 17 chemical elements used in high-tech consumer electronics and military equipment. Rising trade tensions have led to concerns that Beijing will use its dominant position as a supplier of rare earths for leverage in the trade war between the U.S. and China. There is only one rare earth mine and processing facility in the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talks about this with James Litinsky, co-chair of MP Materials, which owns that mine.
China is a global economic power and is ascending on the geopolitical landscape. The U.S. is certainly the most powerful nation on Earth, and there is a natural tension as one nation rises to essentially question the dominance of the other. And I think what we're going to see, and I think that a lot of these skirmishes as far as the trade war, and hopefully Trump and Xi will shake hands tomorrow, but whether they shake hands or not, and whether rare earths are utilized in, you know, as part of a conflict or not, I think the bigger picture thing happening is that there is a significant, extreme amount of economic competition that is now happening between the U.S. and China that has been heightened by the trade war tensions. And frankly, regardless of what happens in the coming couple months, I don't think that that's going to recede anytime soon. I think we're at sort of a new stage of economic development in the world where you're going to see an increasing bifurcation, where you will see, you know, the U.S. economy and the, you know, China's based bloc competing geopolitically. I think the bigger picture thing is that it wouldn't surprise me, because we are sort of at the beginning stages of what is a significant change in the economic landscape.
Good for you and the United States or not?
I think that it's inevitable economic transition in the world. It has the potential to be great for everybody. It has the potential to be terrible for everybody. And the outcome is certainly going to be driven by people on both sides. And the way I see it, I'm a proud American. I love my country. And I view my mission, and certainly the mission of MP Materials, is to perform on a level a global economic playing field. We are looking to produce the lowest cost rare earth product that we can in the world and potentially grow the business from there.
One of the owners, or at least one of the owners of the company that is now operating the Mountain Pass mine, is Chinese. How does that factor in?
Yeah, so we have Shenghe, which is a public company in China and is certainly a very well-respected rare earth operator, has been our technical partner since we closed on the site a couple years ago. And they're an outstanding partner, and we've had a very productive relationship with them. And, you know, certainly they will benefit from our success. And I think that they are, you know, working hard towards our success as we are towards our own success.
Yeah, but how does that factor in as far as the current situation is concerned?
Well, I think as far as what China would do, I think you would have to ask China that. And my guess is that that is a decision Xi will make. And that will be something that, you know, China will decide or not. And I wouldn't be the right person to opine on what the Chinese government's going to do.
Have you had conversations with anyone at the Chinese company that's part owner of your operation?
They're certainly, you know, our technical advisor and partner. And so, as you can imagine, people at our company are talking to people at their company all the time. But I think that there's something very important to recognize, which is Mountain Pass sits in California. It's actually a 50-minute drive from the Las Vegas Strip. There are 200 Americans working on that site. We are through our stage one operations. We are about to, you know, by sometime next year, we'll be through with our stage two operations, which will mean we'll be producing separated rare earth. At any one time, we may have a couple people on site sort of visiting and helping from our Chinese technical advisor. But frankly, I don't think that at this point there really would be any kind of dramatic change. It's not, you know, it's not as if our partner could pick up the mine and move it to China, right? It's a gigantic ore body, and there's a, you know, $1.7 billion processing facility that's built on site, and the entire site, you know, the approximately 200 people working there are Americans. And so regardless of what happens, fingers crossed, barring some event, our people will continue to work regardless of what is done. So certainly could something be done in China that would hurt a Chinese company's economic interest in our asset? Certainly. Could the Chinese government do something that would hurt us economically? Of course. But it's difficult for us to kind of assess the probabilities of those events. Our goal, we are maniacally focused on being a low-cost producer to the world, particularly because we have a very environmentally friendly facility as well, that we will have a reason to exist and we will be able to exist.
All right. That China accounted for 80% of rare earth imports between 2014 and 2017 by the U.S. That was VOA Asia's Ira Melman talking to James Litinsky, co-chair of MP Materials. The U.K. remains in limbo with a vote to leave the European Union, but no clear path on how to do it. The future is uncertain following the resignation of Prime Minister Theresa May, who failed to get a real deal. Joining us to talk more about it is London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, is it safe to say that Theresa May was forced out?
That is accurate, and it's been a long time coming, to be fair. This has been expected for some time. I think it came to a head last week because she had one last vote, one last opportunity to get Parliament behind her in support of her Brexit agreement. And once it became clear that she wouldn't get the support she needed, it was an obvious call to cancel the vote and announce her resignation. So she will officially step down on June 7th. And she chose this date specifically to ensure that when Trump visits the UK next week, everything will go smoothly. This was a good decision, even though it's no secret that she will be stepping down, at least for all of this pomp and circumstance and ceremonial state affairs. We'll have a prime minister in place, which is far better than the alternative.
Given that she is soon to be gone, the big question is who will replace her? Are there any clues so far?
Well, it's starting to look a lot like the Democratic Party in America over here. We've seen more than half a dozen members of the Conservative Party raise their hand to replace her. The leader of the pack has unsurprisingly been Boris Johnson, who has long held this not-so-secret ambition to be prime minister. In fact, he's had a sort of Machiavellian role in all of this because he's a highly political figure who is all about posturing and maneuvering behind the scenes to sort of serve his self-interests. And so it's believed that really ever since the original Brexit referendum was announced, this was what Boris had his eyes on, the prize of being prime minister. So it'll be interesting to see who actually emerges as the winner. Meantime, we've seen the foreign secretary, the home secretary, and a host of other people throw their names in the ring. Boris is favored to win at this point, but I think the jury's really out. I think there are a lot of strong candidates within the Conservative Party, all with a lot of credibility and all with some good ideas. And the major platform that they're all kind of using here is, well, I'll be the one to save the Brexit deal. No, I'll be the one to renegotiate a Brexit deal. And of course, Boris is taking a different tack, saying, I'll be the one to crash out of the EU with a no deal if need be. So we don't know yet who it's going to be, but this has been the strategy, is to really hang their hat on Brexit.
So what happens next at this point? And is there a chance that the referendum will get another vote, given all that's happened?
Well, it's really too early to say what will happen with any kind of referendum. That's being bandied about in some corners, but that's by and large not a big part of the conversation right now. What happens next is the nominations will close on June 10th. Then we'll have successive rounds of voting by the Conservative MPs to decide which candidates to put forward for a vote of the party's members. And then that process should be complete by the end of June, which will leave time for the finalists to have more meetings with other people and people outside the party. And then the final votes will be cast and the result will be announced probably by the time Parliament adjourns for the summer, and that'll be mid-July. So we're looking at about 6 weeks before we know who will take the role of Prime Minister.
That's London-based journalist Amy Gutman. Meanwhile, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn on Tuesday said he is set to back a second Brexit referendum. The U.S. faces a massive shortage of healthcare professionals over the next decade, including up to 120,000 physicians by 2030, according to data by the Association of American Medical Colleges. And with an aging U.S. population and workforce, immigrant doctors and nurses are playing a growing role in healthcare, especially in rural areas where staff shortages are most severe. But as VOA's Ramon Taylor reports, their help alone may not be enough to end the crisis.
In rural countrysides across America, an aging population has a growing problem: access to health care. In Danville, Pennsylvania, a borough of roughly 4,600, people travel more than an hour to get to the hospital. The town's flagship medical center, with a workforce population greater than all of Danville, says it needs non-native workers to keep its optimal nurse-to-patient levels. And the shortage is expected to get even worse.
Like many hospitals across the country, Geisinger is faced with an aging community population and, quite frankly, an aging workforce. And so we have to look at our workforce of the future and what that might look like.
So the hospital is turning to international registered nurses like Jamaican native Hemoy Drummond.
It's not easy to move with two girls away from family. Usually you're moving closer to family, but I took the chance.
Nationwide, nearly 15% of nurses and 23% of health aides are immigrants, according to research by New American Economy. Geisinger touts professional growth opportunities to attract international talent.
A long-term goal would be to get my certification in neuroscience and probably in the longer run, be a nurse manager.
But with more than 1.3 million healthcare job openings expected over the next decade, hospitals need more help. The workforce gap is growing across the sector, from home health aides to specialized physicians, and especially in rural areas.
If you look at urban areas, something like there are 200 doctors or over 200 doctors per 100,000 people. But if you look at rural counties, the coverage or the number of doctors to go around is much less, something like 82 for every 100,000.
On May 16, President Trump announced a new merit-based immigration plan, but it is unclear whether this would help the shortage of medical professionals if it ever became law. Like Geisinger, Chambersburg Hospital is relying on non-native workers. Roughly half its medicine physicians are foreign graduates.
When we interviewed, we didn't find sufficient American graduate. But somehow they don't like small town or something like that. So if we interview like 10 American graduate, maybe one show up.
Kurdistan, northern Iraq, Pakistan.
VOA spoke with 10 foreign-born doctors in Chambersburg. Nine expressed a willingness to stay.
I love my patients. I love what I'm doing in Chambersburg. Right? And most physicians, once they start off at a particular place and they form bonds with their own patients, it's tough for them to move to another area.
Indian physicians like Dr. Tirupathi face a long wait for permanent residency due to a green card backlog. Tirupathi says he hopes his commitment to the town will not be taken for granted. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, Danville, Pennsylvania.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues now. The Smithsonian Institution's hugely popular museums and zoo in Washington have a new boss. Lonnie Bunch III is the first African-American to hold the post, and he is the founding director of the National Museum of African-American History and Culture in Washington. VOA's David Byrd has more.
The Smithsonian's museums offer visitors to Washington the chance to see everything from the Hope Diamond to dinosaur skeletons, to Claude Monet's paintings, to the Wright Brothers flyer. As of April of this year, more than 6.5 million people had visited one or more of the Smithsonian's museums or the National Zoo. Now, for the first time since it opened in 1846, an African American will serve as secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. Lonnie Bunch III is best known for being the founding director of the newest museum on the Mall, the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Bunch told the Associated Press that he is humbled and excited at taking over as secretary.
It is humbling, exciting. It is something that had never crossed my mind to do, but it also makes me feel good because I get to give back to the institution I care the most about, the Smithsonian.
The Smithsonian's 17-member Board of Regents unanimously selected Bunch for the job. Previously, he took over the African American History Museum and shepherded it and its more than 40,000 artifacts until its opening in 2016. Before that, Bunch worked for the National Museum of American History. However, he says he was still surprised to get the secretary's job.
I wasn't even sure when they asked me to you know, go for this job, that they'd hire somebody like me, that they'd hire an insider, they'd hire a curator, they'd hire a historian.
The new secretary says he does not want people to think of the Smithsonian as only looking at the past. He wants the public to see it as suited to serving a 21st century audience.
And so in a way, this is also a wonderful day for the Smithsonian. To sort of say it's a place that embraces all of what America is and is comfortable with diversity of leadership and vision. So for me, this is less about a triumph for me and more about the Smithsonian recognizing what it takes to lead in the 21st century.
Lonnie Bunch III will assume his new duties as secretary of the Smithsonian Institution on June 16th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Actress and singer Jennifer Hudson felt the spirit of the Queen of Soul Monday in Chicago, where she performed a rousing performance of Amazing Grace, bringing the audience of journalists to their feet. She was there to honor the late, great Aretha Franklin, who was posthumously awarded the Pulitzer Prize Special Citation Honor on Tuesday. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.